along on a spare tire that needed air and feeling like a lousy mom. I was barely in the door when Sandy wheedled a confession out of me, and the next thing I knew, she and the sisterhood were deep in a plan to arrange a surprise party for Zoe that evening. Before long, we'd called everyone we could think of to make a crowd, Brother Gilbo, Bink and Geneva, Greg and Crystal from Boathouse Barbecue, a couple other shopkeepers Zoe had gotten to know. I called Gina's cell, but she didn't answer, so I left a message inviting her to the party. Ross was headed to meet his buddies at the beach, but he promised he would show up at the shop in time. Sandy texted her afternoon shop girls, Stephanie and Megan, and arranged for them to grab Zoe after school and tell her she was needed at Sandy's. On the way, they would delay a bit with a trip to the grocery store so that Paul and JT could get to the shop and join the party group. When I tried to thank Sandy, she just smiled and said, "Are you kidding? We wouldn't even be open if it weren't for you." Then she pulled me into a shoulder hug and added, "Besides, this is how the sisterhood works. We take care of each other. There are all different kinds of sisters, Tandy, not just the ones you're born with." The phone rang, and she released me so she could cross the room and answer it. A minute later, she was laughing and saying, "Well, I think that sounds just great. I'll call some more people. We'll make it a combination birthday bash and grand reopening party. We haven't danced out on the deck since last fall before the hurricane. This will be a night to remember, to put all the bad times behind us and celebrate." Sharon and I were watching her quizzically when she hung up the phone. "Okay, what's going on?" Sharon paused with a necklace dangling from her fingers, the green beach glass twisting in the glow of display lights. Sandy's eyes twinkled. "Brother Gilbo just called. He wondered if we'd like a little Zydeco music, said his band hasn't played anywhere in a while and they need to tune up. I told him, sure, if we're going to have a party, we might as well really make it a blowout celebration, right? It's Friday night, and heaven only knows it's time for some joy around here. Neither can flood nor pestilence nor building inspectors with attitude overcome those who labor justly. Amen?" "Amen," Sharon agreed and pumped a fist. She and I exchanged giddy looks before Sandy put us both to work. Zoe's birthday party was taking on a life of its own. The rest of the day was taken up with party planning and wild preparations. When Sandy seized on an idea, the woman was a force of nature. By afternoon, Boathouse Barbecue was planning to open its doors for a $5 barbecue and boiled shrimp buffet, and the bakery down the street was remaking a failed wedding cake into a birthday-slash-grand-reopening centerpiece. At the seashell shop, we baked cookies as fast as we could in the single oven that wasn't meant for large baking jobs. "I don't know if you realize what you've gotten yourself into," I told Brother Gilbo when he and his band arrived with equipment to set up on the patio. "Oh-wee, we gonna have us a good time tonight." Brother Gilbo laughed. "I got the information out to everybody on my list. Half the island's gonna be here. We gonna celebrate this day." "It looks like we are." I handed him an extension cord from Sandy and went back inside to try to call Gina again. I'd phoned the house and her cell, but she hadn't answered. Standing there with my hand on the button, I had the fleeting thought that it might be for the best if she didn't answer. When Gina partied, she really liked to party. And though mixed drinks weren't on the menu at Sandy's, there was a bar right down the street. What if my sister got lit and embarrassed Zoe and all the rest of us? I didn't call her again, and instead started hoping she wouldn't get my messages. By 3:30, everything was in place. Paul had brought JT from school, our small crowd of friends was milling around in the shop, and we were just waiting for Zoe to arrive and kick off the celebration.
"What time did you say this shindig was supposed to happen?"
Ross was impatient. He'd left the water to come. As soon as we blew out the candles and cut the cake, he was planning to head back to the beach for a couple hours, then return later once the grand reopening party really cranked up. "Any minute now. At least stay until Zoe gets here and opens her presents, okay?" Ross had even thought to bring a gift for Zoe, something wrapped in a surf shop bag. I wanted him to see the driftwood box. Paul had seen it as I was working on it, but Ross hadn't. I was proud of the way the box had turned out. Watching Zoe unwrap it and find the note and sea glass necklace inside would be fun. I hope she liked it.
"Okay, okay."
Ross checked his watch again, then scanned the room, his gaze drawing a bead on JT and Paul, who were messing around in one corner of the sandbox, Paul sitting on his knees like a little kid.
"You sure Zoe's gonna like this old party thing? I mean, hanging out with a bunch of old people isn't exactly a teenager's idea of fun."
A sliver of worry needled me. Not that I hadn't thought of that possibility as the party morphed into something so elaborate, but I didn't need to hear it out loud. The phone rang, and from the corner of my eye, I could see Sandy motioning me to the front counter. The look on her face told me instantly that something was wrong. My mind tripped, stumbled, and fell into action. Car wreck? Trouble at school? Maybe Stephanie and Megan missed Zoe after classes let out. Maybe Rowdy or someone else gave her a ride? But why wouldn't she come onto the shell shop? She usually works in the afternoons. Sandy covered the phone when I reached the counter. It's Megan. She and Stephanie are in the administration office. Zoe's not at school. The secretary says your sister checked her out hours ago. What? Sandy handed me the phone, and I talked briefly to Megan, and then to the school secretary. Gina had taken Zoe shopping for her birthday. I'm really sorry, the secretary pleaded. Zoe didn't seem worried about it. I definitely got the idea that the shopping trip was something planned. It was, but not today. When I did find my sister, I was going to choke her. I really was. How dare she pick up my daughter without even asking me? Didn't she even consider that I probably had plans, that this was Zoe's birthday and I wanted to be with her? I knew the answer. Of course she didn't, because this was Gina, and she always did these things. Whatever felt good in the moment, whatever she wanted. As soon as I was off the phone with the school, I called her cell again. I was conscious of Sandy staring at me with fire in her eyes. If Gina did bring Zoe here, I wouldn't have to kill her. The sisterhood would do it for me. Gina's line rang and went to voicemail. The message I left probably sizzled the air between the shop and the nearest cell tower. Sandy announced a change of plans for the party. Okay, little delay, she chirped. The birthday girl surprised us, I guess. She's out shopping with her aunt. We'll just go ahead with the Sandy Seashell Shop grand reopening party, and when Zoe gets here, we'll break out the cake and candles. When the crowd didn't immediately switch gears, Sandy fanned her hands, giving everyone the shoo-shoo. Now come on, everybody, don't be shy. Greg and Crystal, you'd better get that buffet going. I sent out emails all over town, and I put it on the Facebook page. Before you can blink, people will be bubbling up on the deck like ghost crabs under a full moon. Brother Gilbo, you and your boys grab a bite of food while you can. We'll be needing some good music pretty quick. I'm ready to dance. The storm came, the storm went, and we're still here. If that's not a reason to celebrate, I don't know what is. As the guests filed out to the patio, I called Gina's phone again. No answer. Chapter 23. I was dozing on my sofa when Gina and Zoe finally came in. A storm had blown in around 9 and chased the crowd off the patio at Sandy's. By then, the party was a huge success, if you didn't factor in Zoe's absence and the uneaten birthday cake, and the fact that I was seriously contemplating making myself an only child. The idea that Gina would take off with Zoe without even asking and then keep her out until after 11 o'clock on her birthday made me insane. When I heard the cottage door unlocking, I whiplashed from drowsiness and anxiety to rage. Zoe appeared in the opening first. Gina probably planned it that way, using my daughter as a human shield. Where have you been? The words were an angry hiss. I wanted to scream them, but JT had already gone to bed, exhausted after the big night at Sandy's. Zoe was all smiles, and so far there was no sign of Gina, other than a car door closing outside. Zoe had a shopping bag in each hand, and her hair was hanging in glitter-sprayed curls, pulled away from her face by a rhinestone-studded headband. She was wearing way too much makeup. Long red fingernails clutched the handles of her shopping bags, and she was dressed in a black miniskirt and impossibly high silver platform shoes. She looked 25. "Come see what we got," she said, then trotted across the room, wobbling in the heels as she grabbed my hand and pulled me off the sofa. She was so giddy that for a minute I was afraid she and Gina had been out drinking together. But Zoe was sober under all that makeup. "It's like the cutest thing ever, and it's four-wheel drive, and now we can go on the beach without getting stuck. And Aunt Gina says that next year, when I get my license, I can have it, and she'll get another car, and..." Zoe didn't stop until she had me out the door. In the driveway, Gina was lounging on the hood of a vintage ragtop Jeep. In tight jeans, shoes that matched Zoe's, a silver tank top, and enough jewelry to choke a horse, she looked like an auto show model doing a night shot under the porch lights. "Like it?" she asked. "I came out 6K ahead, too. That car dealer over in Norfolk didn't even know what hit him, did he, Zoe Bear? We're gonna have some good times in this car, baby sister. I mean, does this say I live in paradise or what?" "Zoe, go inside." She didn't need to hear what I was about to say, especially not on her birthday. Norfolk. Gina had dragged Zoe off to Norfolk to trade in the Acura. Between the 3-hour drive over and rush hour traffic later on, my sister had known full well that they would be gone all evening. Mama, Zoe protested. Just go inside, okay? I'm not mad at you. But Mama, Zoe, please. Zoe ducked her head and slipped into the cottage, muttering, great, as the door closed behind her by itself. I felt the sting of instantly being made the bad guy, despite the fact that I hadn't done anything wrong. Gina was the guilty one here. What? Gina unfolded from her sultry pose and slid off the Jeep. Oh, seriously? You're mad. I do something to get some cash for us, and I take little Zoe Bear birthday shopping, and you're mad at me. You didn't even ask me, Gina. You checked my daughter out of school without making sure it was okay, and you just took off. You knew I told her I'd take her out for her birthday. My sister's chin jutted out, her hair flying in moon platinum strings. Her face was in shadow, but I knew the self-righteous expression that would go with that posture. We had fun. I showed her a good time. I spoiled her a little. What's so wrong with that? What, you don't trust me now? No, you know what? I don't. I needed her to be here. Here, Gina. You never even thought about the fact that I wanted to spend my daughter's birthday with her? That I might have plans. We had a surprise party all ready for her at the seashell shop, and we couldn't even find her. She missed the whole thing. Gina was momentarily silenced, frozen in stop motion before coming to life with a return volley. Well, just do it tomorrow. It'll be like double birthdays. How did I answer that? It wasn't even worthy of an answer. I've been calling you all evening. Why didn't you pick up the phone? But I knew why. Gina wanted to do what she wanted to do, and she wasn't going to let me get in the way. If she didn't pick up the phone, she didn't have to answer to anyone. She glanced at the Jeep as if it might hold the answers. Oh, I think I left my phone. I didn't realize it until we were on the road. She started toward the cottage, indicating that I'd reminded her of the loss of her cell, and now she needed to conduct an emergency search. When she got in there, she would magically come up with it under the bed or someplace and pretend it had been there all along. She probably had it in her pocket or her purse right now. It's not here, Gina. There's no cell phone in here. I should know. I've been calling it enough. Off, I mean. She finished smoothly. I wondered why I hadn't had any calls all afternoon. She burrowed in her purse, pulled out the phone, checked it, and added, Yep, turned off. Sorry about that. This stupid smartphone. Half the time it's... Stop it! The echo reverberated across the yard, stealing through the trees and the climbing roses and bouncing off Iola's house. Just stop it, Gina. Don't you ever, ever take my kids anywhere again. Do you hear me? You ruined everything tonight. Disappointment, pain, bitterness welled in my throat. Why did it always have to be this way? Why couldn't we be like sisters were supposed to be? Why couldn't we have what Iola and Isabel had? Why did anything we felt for each other, any interaction we had, have to be crisscrossed by scabs of pain and misunderstanding? Couldn't the wounds ever heal? I went into the cottage without waiting for her to answer the spoken question, or the unspoken ones. What was the point? Closing the door hard, I let my forehead rest against it. Outside, the Jeep rumbled to life and backed out of the drive, then sped away. Mama? Zoe's voice was a thin ribbon in the storm of anger and disappointment. When I turned around, she was standing by the kitchen table next to the pile of gifts and the remodeled wedding cake that still read, Happy Birthday, Zoe, from the Seashell Shop Gang. In her hands, Zoe was holding the driftwood box, a folded note open against her thumb, wrapping paper lying at her feet. I'm sorry, Mama. A tear spilled from the deep blue ocean of one eye and trailed down her cheek as I crossed the room, opening my arms to her. I love you, baby, I whispered, taking in the scents of hairspray and perfume at first. But beneath those, the scents of the little girl who had come from the body of a lost, lonely, terrified 19-year-old. Happy birthday, Zoe. We held each other and rocked back and forth, swaying to the rhythm the two of us were only now beginning to understand. The dance of mother and daughter. The birthday celebration was just Zoe and me, the recycled cake and a tub of ice cream. Zoe kicked off her platform shoes and opened her gifts from the shell shop crowd, and before she went to bed, I hung the blue mermaid's tear necklace around her neck. When I finally turned out the cottage lights, there was still no sign of Gina, and I wasn't sorry. She would show up when she figured things had cooled off, and unless I brought it up, she would act like the whole thing had never happened. Gina had always been that way. She didn't apologize, she just moved on. We needed to have a talk about boundaries if she was going to stay here on Hatteras. But I wondered if talking would do any good. Sitting on the edge of my bed, I took a pad of paper from the night table and wrote down my hopes, then put them in my prayer box and tucked it inside the drawer beside my bed. The vision of a future with my sister was still murky and uncertain, but one thing I'd learned from my oldest letters was that miraculous answers to prayer were possible. The other thing I'd learned was that prayers aren't always answered the way you expect. On Saturday morning, Zoe was up early on her own and waiting to go to work with me. She wanted to tell everyone at the seashell shop that she was sorry she'd missed the party. She'd showered off the makeup and washed the glitter from her hair, and she looked 15 again. JT had plans to go fishing with Paul. Gina hadn't reappeared during the night, and maybe I should have been worried, but I wasn't. I knew Gina too well. She didn't mean anything bad by it, you know. She sold her car to get money for all of us, Zoe pointed out as we pulled into the shop parking lot. The mermaid's tear dangled around her neck, a reminder of the two-person birthday party that turned out just right. Her lips trembled downward at the edges as she reached for her door handle, then stopped.
I wish you wouldn't be mad at Aunt Gina, okay? Everybody doesn't like her already.
I'm just disappointed. Zoe's eyes were filled with so much hope right now, so much faith in my sister. I didn't want her to be hurt if Gina changed directions and took off with her sights set on something new. Let's not talk about it, okay? Let's just have a good day. I leaned over the console and smoothed Zoe's hair. It was a good day. Zoe looked adorable in her new birthday dress from Sandy's shop. The sun was out, the tourist crowd looked promising. I wanted to just enjoy all that was good and right, to forget about Gina, at least for now, and just live in the bliss. Unfortunately, we were only halfway through the day before Gina showed up at the shop, and my bliss came crashing back to earth. Gina was all smiles and gifts. She bought silver necklaces, two halves of a heart with "My Sister, My Friend" printed on them. One for me, one for her. Our names were engraved on the backs. "Friends again?" she said as she dangled mine in front of me. I tucked it into my pocket. I'm not supposed to wear jewelry here unless it's from the shop. Well, that's a stupid rule. Sandy gave her a dirty look. Whether I chose to forgive Gina or not, it was fairly clear that she wouldn't be invited into the sisterhood of the seashell shop anytime soon. But okay, Gina added, smiling at me. You guys here for the whole day? Because I was thinking we could take the Jeep out, drive down the beach. We're here for the day. I was careful to indicate that Zoe would be staying, too. She, Megan, and Stephanie were enjoying themselves, making sail posters and shell-based decorations for a sidewalk display out front. JT's gone fishing with Paul, so don't try to kidnap him, either. Gina yawned behind her hand. She looked warmed over this morning. Think I'll mosey on home and catch a few winks in. I'm beat. I didn't argue with her. I just let her go. Sandy gave me a dirty look for that, too. Not long after Gina was gone, she caught me in a corner and told me I should kick my sister to the curb. Not that I'm trying to tell you your business, she added. I just need time to think it all through. I didn't want to be a wimp, but Sandy had no idea how Gina could be when you made her mad. She's the only family I have. You've got us. Sandy's gaze met mine, and she sighed, her shoulders slumping. But I know you're a big girl. You can make your own decisions, and I need to butt out. I had a feeling she'd been told that more than once before. The line had a practiced quality to it. I love it that you care. I turned back to making coffee. After so many years of dysfunctional relationships that masqueraded as love, having someone offer real love and ask nothing for it in return was startling, sometimes too much to handle. I wasn't sure I could trust it or was worthy of it. Well, just remember, we're here if you need a friend, a bouncer, anything. Sandy circled the counter and went out the back door to the glass shop. After a busy week, she and Sharon were working on more boxes, wind chimes, and sun catchers. During the unbirthday party last night, she'd asked me again to make more driftwood boxes. She especially liked the technique of filling the cracks with shell hash and lacquering over it. She was sure that my boxes would sell for big dollars in the shop. She described them as sea art. I'd never thought of myself as an artist, but I guessed I was. A while later, the shop phone rang, and it was Paul. I'd noticed that so far, he had subtly refused to call me on the cell that Ross had given me. Paul hadn't come right out and said it, but he didn't like Ross or my sister any more than Sandy did. "Hey, so how was the fishing?" I asked. "Did you and JT catch anything?" There was a strange pause on the other end.
"Listen, Tandy, I've got some bad news. I mean, not about JT or anything. He's fine, but earlier today we were fishing the boiler up at Pea Island, and I got to talking to a couple guys who were there. Anyway, Fairhope came up, and they said they'd heard that some property had been condemned in Fairhope for flood retention and a borrow pit. I told them I didn't know anything about it, but it's been bothering me all day. So I finally made a few calls, and, well, as far as I can tell, they're talking about Iola's house. We've got to reel in the lines here and pack things up, but I'm headed to Binks to see if they've heard anything. This doesn't sound good, though."
The fear that had been lingering in the back of my mind for weeks now bubbled to the surface. In some way, I'd known this was coming, but in another way, I'd been living in total denial, pretending Iola's big white house would always be there. If the situation was about to change, I had to get there first to at least take care of the boxes before Iola's letters could become fodder for public discussion. "Paul, I'm headed home. There's something I have to do there. I'll need help, and I need the ladder, the tall one, okay?"
"No problem. Whatever you need. I'll go by Binks and then meet you there."
We hung up, and I hurried to the workshop to find Sandy. Zoe was out there with her, learning to solder the leading on sea glass picture frames. Sandy pushed her goggles up and beamed at me when I came through the door.
"I'll tell you, we're going to have to keep this girl."
The smile faded mid-sentence.
"What in the world is wrong? You look like you've seen a ghost."
I explained the situation with Iola's house, and within a few minutes, Zoe and I were hurrying out the door.
"Anything you need, you just call me," Sandy yelled after us.
I realized it was the second time I'd heard that in less than 15 minutes. "Anything you need." What could I possibly have done to deserve people like Paul and Sandy? And Iola. I couldn't let the house be demolished. Somehow, I had to find a way. Yes, there was storm damage, but the place could still be saved. It had withstood 100 years of storms. It shouldn't be taken down by a wrecking ball, by someone's random decision that the property should be used for something else. Adrenaline surged through my body as we drove home, and with it came determination, a sense of focus. Just as quickly, I felt it draining like a wave retreating into the sea. My skin went cold and clammy as we pulled into the driveway. Gina's new Jeep was parked in front of the cottage, and beside it, a tricked-out four-wheel drive truck that I recognized. Ross's. Zoe slanted a glance my way as we drifted to a stop without pulling into the cottage parking nook. All of a sudden, I wished I'd left my daughter behind. "Zoe, go over to Binks and see if Paul and JT are there, okay? Tell them we're home."
"But Mama..."
"Just go." My stomach was churning, my mind racing ahead, dashing back and forth between harmless explanations for those two vehicles being parked together, and terrible visions of why they probably were. Zoe slid from the truck and jogged off across the yard, casting nervous backward glances as I crossed the driveway and walked up the steps to the cottage. I waited until she was out of sight before going in. The door was unlocked, but no one was inside. Maybe Gina had some kind of trouble with the new Jeep, and she called Ross. Maybe the obnoxious man from the county came back, and Gina was worried, and... So many logical scenarios, but none seemed to fit. There had never been logic where my sister was concerned. Only impulse and a constant wild changing of direction, like the sails on an unmanned boat, the boom swinging dangerously in the wind. A part of me knew. I felt it as I walked out the door of the cottage again, looked around the yard, toward the hedges, toward the barn, toward Iola's house. Something moved beyond the glass, just a transient form, a ghost, a specter from the past, from all the other times that I'd hoped and believed and yearned and wanted. And been disappointed. Dread flowed cold inside me as I crossed the yard, tiptoed up the porch steps, settled my hand on the doorknob, heard Gina's raucous laughter, high and light. They didn't even notice me when I stepped inside. They were too busy on the rug in front of the parlor fireplace, Gina slipping out of her sundress seductively, Ross with his shirt off, one arm braced, his flesh ruddy and tan against hers. I felt sick, then wounded, then filled with rage. "Get out!" I screamed, grabbing a cheap ceramic flower pot from the hallway table. I flung it at them, and it shattered against the hearth. "How dare you come in here? You have no right. Get out. Both of you, get out." Ross stood first, grabbing the loose ends of his belt.
"Tandy, wait a minute,
Gina blinked in surprise, looked from me to Ross and back as she pulled her sundress into place. "Tandy, it's not what it looks. So is this where you were last night?" I spat. "First my daughter and now Ross? If I have it, you want to get your hands on it, just to prove you can. That's how it's always been, right? I was an idiot to think things could be any different."
"Tandy, I didn't mean for this to..."
Gina stood, faced me.
"It wasn't any... Nothing happened, okay? I wasn't with him last night, I swear. Just calm down, okay?"
"Leave," I growled. Her lips pressed into a thin line, her nostrils flaring.
"You know what? You're the same Brett you always were. I sold my car for you, to help you out, to get us a place. And if we're going to talk about people keeping secrets, why don't we talk about yours? I've seen you over here with the lights on at night, sneaking around when you think no one's watching. What are you doing in this house all the time, Tandy?"
She rammed her hands onto her hips, glared at the walls. Beside her, Ross looked completely confused, but Gina had homed in.
"Maybe making a few bucks on the side, because there's lots of stuff around here that's worth some money. Wonder what Brother Bilbo next door would say if I told him you're in here all the time, that you come over here for hours sometimes. No telling what you've stolen out of this place, because that's who you are, Tandy. You're going around trying to make these people think you're so good. You think they really love you. You think they won't figure it out. You're nothing. We are just like Mama and Daddy, and we always will be. Once these people find out who you really are, you'll be out on the street, and you'll come crawling back, looking for somebody to make it okay. Blood runs thicker than water, little sister."
Fear made me hesitate, freeze up just long enough for Gina to narrow her sights, put me in her crosshairs. Blood runs thicker than water. Her posture softened, her head tilting to one side, the strap of the sundress sliding down her shoulder. Her lips curved upward at the corners, the expression almost tender, alluring.
"You should see yourself. You look like a deer caught in the headlights. Relax, it's okay. Hey, it's not like the old lady can use this stuff anymore. Why shouldn't somebody have it? Come on, we could look around and..."
My anger exploded in a white-hot flash, and before I knew it, I was crossing the room, grabbing the fireplace poker, brandishing it at my sister. "You get out of this house. I'm not anything like you and Mama and Daddy, and I never will be. You get out and don't come back.
Right now."
The voice came from behind me, and I realized it was Paul's. He was standing in the entry hall, his face deadly serious. In his hand, he was holding a heavy wooden spindle from the porch railing, tapping it against his palm like a baseball bat. His red hair was wild around his head, his face flushed beneath the freckles as if he'd been running.
"If Tandy wants you out, then get out, both of you."
Gina coughed indignantly, drawing her head upward. Ross lifted his hands, palms out, and sidestepped toward the door.
"Look, dude, this isn't worth it, okay? I didn't come for a fight. I'm gone."
He turned and quit the room. Gina flashed a look filled with resentment and anger, and even though we'd played this scene out so many times before, it still stung. She stormed after Ross, her heels clicking through the entry hall and across the porch. Tears filled my eyes, and I wiped them impatiently, then turned away from Paul, filled with pain and shame. "You're nothing. We're just like Mama and Daddy, and we always will be. Once these people find out who you really are, you'll be out on the street, and you'll come crawling back." Gina knew me. She knew my life from the very beginning. "I'm sorry, Paul." I swallowed the acidic mix inside me, stuffed it down, and pulled a hard covering over it. "You should leave, too. Why wait for it to happen on its own? Who was I fooling, thinking I could change my life, change everything about me? I was like Iola, an actress on a stage, playing a part for the rest of the world to see, denying who I was. If Paul knew where I'd come from, he wouldn't want a thing to do with me. Neither would Sandy or Brother Gilbo or the rest of the Seashell Shop girls. It was easier, less painful to just speed up the natural progression of things. I could do Iola this last favor, clean out the letters and throw them away and then leave. If Trammell was a big story in Texas now, there might be some money to be made telling my side, letting the world know what it was really like living in his house. But I'm going, Paul said. And the hard place inside me clenched tighter, the skin ripening, preparing for harvest. A bitter fruit. He lowered the wooden spindle, his fingers relaxing against the cracked surface and peeling paint. I nodded, closed my eyes. I didn't want to watch him walk out, to see the beginning of the end of this life. But just to get my head, it blew off as I was running over here. I looked at him, standing there, thumbing over his shoulder in a ridiculous peach-colored shirt with dancing geckos on it. I couldn't speak. And the kids, I guess, he went on. I left them at Banks. I was afraid there might be trouble here. Outside, vehicles started and roared away, and Paul turned an ear to the sound, listening until they were both gone, before he looked at me again. Besides, if I leave, my long ladder's going with me. I priced new ones at Home Depot the other day, and do you know how much those things cost? A puff of laughter pushed past the mountain of pain. Impossible laughter that came from someplace new. Somewhere soft and bright, far from all the old wounds. I wanted to step into it, but I was afraid. That place was wide open, vulnerable. Paul, you don't have to. He smiled and shook his head, met my eyes. Not everyone's the same, Tandy. Not everyone is working the angles, looking for something. People can care about you just for you, just because you're worth caring about. I felt the warmth inside, the explosion of the light I'd seen in my dream flowing over me, enveloping me. I wanted to step into it, to be covered by it, blinded by it. The only thing stopping me was fear. It clenched my throat, made words impossible to find. I could only stand there, silent. Anyway, we've got work to do. Paul straightened, suddenly all business. We have to come up with a plan. I just found out there's a county commission meeting on Monday. They want to condemn this house and the property around it as a flood control zone, then dig a borrow pit here to excavate sand to restore the beaches around those multi-million-dollar homes that are sitting in water since the storm. In the end, they'll turn this whole place into a holding pond for flood retention. If they do that, not only is this house finished, but there won't be anything left of Fairhope that's worth having. He walked out the door, and I stood looking around the house, thinking of everything that had happened here, the way this place had changed my life, changed me. It wasn't right that Iola's house be destroyed in order to save homes that had been built only a few years ago. This couldn't happen. It's wrong, I whispered. If people knew how much you loved this island, if they knew everything you did for them, if they knew who you really were. It came to me then, the answer. If we were to have any chance of saving Iola's house, we had to tell the people her story. Chapter 24. Is there, in you, a forgiveness for sins of the father or the mother? Is there an absolution for the innocent, for the fragile life that had no say in its beginnings? For a wife who carries secrets to the wedding bed? Forgive me, Father. For I have sinned. I have sinned the sin of lies and love. I have hidden all the parts of me he does not know. For him, I have become the mask of passion, of love. I have entered into this sacrament a shell with nothing inside that does not hide in the shadows. And now there is life growing, and it is loved, yet it lives so near the darkness. Will you forgive me, Father? Will you forgive this child? I yearn to cast aside the fear, to tell, and I fear I can never tell. I wonder at this web of lies, and I feel it tightening. Love cannot live in the darkness, in the shadows. It is a growing thing, a thing of light. I, a child of lies, know this so well. But I come before you. And I fall on my knees, and I beg you, Father, show mercy. Iola was a wife, a newly expectant mother traveling home to stay with her husband's family. 2 months after their secret marriage in a tiny church on the Swiss border, her husband, Marcus, had been injured in a landmine explosion, and she found herself en route to Nevada with him. She'd discovered her pregnancy only weeks before, and she was filled with fear. The life she'd built after joining the WAAC suddenly seemed to be compressing around her. She'd told her husband nothing about her history, other than that she'd grown up in a convent school and had no family. She'd kept her pregnancy secret so far. Paul's cell phone rang in the closet, and I jumped. Deep in Iola's letters, I'd forgotten there was anyone else in the house, much less in the room. Paul had been moving boxes down from the upper shelves and searching through them, ferreting out Iola's connections with others on the island, the people she'd included in her prayer letters, the causes she'd secretly supported. Paul was discovering Iola's life from the top down, while I worked from the bottom up. We photographed bits of her history with Paul's phone, slowly compiling her story, documenting all the ways she had used the Benoit money to change lives on the Outer Banks and far beyond. Over the years, she'd given the Benoit Shipping Company over to its employees, allowing the board of directors to create stock option plans, retirement funds, medical plans, and college scholarships for employees' children. She'd helped fund libraries, schools, churches, and parks intended to preserve the wild spaces of the Outer Banks for future generations. She'd helped new businesses like Sandy's, often making purchases from local shops and then donating the items to charity auctions and nonprofit programs. She'd aided families in need, sent anonymous donations to pay for cancer treatments, bone marrow drives, a motorized wheelchair for a woman who'd lost her legs in an accident on the docks. As her cash resources slowly dwindled, she began using items of value in the house to continue to do the work she felt compelled to do. There had been other Tiffany lamps before the Magnolia left the Blue Room. Lamps and paintings and statues and jewelry. Symbols of opulence, slowly given away. Downstairs, Zoe and JT were going through the stacks of newspapers that had been stored among the clutter. As I'd suspected, the newspapers weren't there at random. They were a record, a paper trail of all the needs to which Iola had devoted herself. She'd been an angel of mercy for so many people, always in secret. She'd changed so many lives before she changed mine, the only difference being that I was the last.
This woman was everywhere, Paul commented, coming out of the closet, already reading a letter from a box pulled off the shelf second to the top. It's amazing. This is from a tanker spill in 2008. There was a group of students down in Florida trying to help transport a pod of beach dolphins back out to sea. She sent a massive donation to pay for equipment, along with a copy of an old newspaper article about the whales that were rescued from the ice cover in Barrow, Alaska 20 years before. There was a movie about it a couple of years ago. Remember that? Iola sent money to help fund that rescue, too. She wanted to share the whale's story with the college kids rescuing the dolphins in Florida to inspire them to believe it could be done. I love this woman. Listen to this. Father, help these young people to see. Help them to show the world that our greatness is not in things we do for ourselves, but in things we do for others. In power that channels itself into kindness, in a hand outstretched in love. Be with these determined students. Help them to believe, when the naysayers come, that you make all things possible. And Father, touch your fingertip again to the life of the Mulberry girl, that she might be well. I've not mentioned her in some time, but I know you are mindful of her, as you are mindful of each sparrow of the field.
Paul set the letter atop the box and continued to the desk, smiling at me as he passed.
That is magnificent. This woman is like a tiny St. Francis. Whales, dolphins, cancer patients, Mulberry girls, whatever that means.
Mama, she bought computers for the library, I think, Zoe yelled from the bottom of the stairs. JT's taking a picture of the article.
Good, I called. Keep going through the papers. Save everything we can use. We'll print it all at Binks later. The cell phone from Ross was coming to good use after all. I went back to Iola's letters, sank into her life again as the night ticked by. A squall blew onto the Outer Banks, and we added emptying drip buckets to our tasks as the hours wore on. The water was coming through the ceiling in streams now, seeping down walls, dampening floors and carpets, leaching through to the lower floor. Paul gave the ceiling in the Blue Room a worried look as he passed by the bed where I was reading. I knew what he was thinking. What if the place was too far gone? I focused instead on Iola's life. On the other side of the room, Paul muttered to himself, cataloging letters.
Prayed for the new pastor at the church, prayed for the UPS guy and the Mulberry girl. Ooh, help fund playground equipment at a new community center. Here's a good one.
He grabbed the cell phone from the bed and snapped a photo. I moved through another litter, and another. Water plinked into buckets. Paul snapped pictures.
Mama, we're making some Jiffy Pop, okay?
JT yelled from downstairs.
We're hungry, and it smells yucky down here.
Okay, yes, I called back, frustrated by the distraction as I followed the trail of Iola's life. She'd lost the initial pregnancy after the marriage, and with Marcus redeployed to the war front after recovering from his injuries, she'd waited out the war with his family, learning the life of a ranch wife out west. The Jane Russell-style photo she'd shown to the UPS man had been taken there. There were several shots of Iola in the box, all snapped when she'd gathered with local wives and sweethearts to take photos that would be sent to husbands and beaux overseas, something to boost the morale of the boys fighting far from home. The UPS man was right. Iola had been a beautiful young woman. Olive-skinned, bright-eyed, exotic, her hair flowing over the haystack in rich, dark curls. She looked happy, laughing as the horse nuzzled her, stealing hay from the stack. The photographs captured the moment perfectly. A moment of youth and innocence, of joy. Then the war was over, victory declared in Europe and in Japan, the Allied occupation forces turning to the rebuilding of liberated countries as the botch from 1946 began. Marcus's duty was ending, and he was coming home. He and Iola could finally be together again. A promise of prosperity, peace, and abundance was ahead. They would build a home of their own. Iola's joy had been tempered once more by fear. A new home was a place for a growing family. Marcus, his parents, his brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles expected it. But Iola had heard stories about women of mixed race who entered marriages while keeping secrets, women whose hidden heritage was revealed in the births of their children. She'd heard of illicit ways that a woman could make certain she was never able to conceive. She was afraid. I sat staring at her words, thinking of that moment when I stood outside the abortion clinic, alone, terrified. Pregnant by a man who promised to love me, then didn't. "This is the only way, Tandy," he told me. "I'll take care of you once it's finished. Surely you understand. I have a career to think about, a reputation to protect. Just give me time to work it all out and we can be together. We won't have to hide forever." I understood the fear inside Iola Ann, the desperation, the consuming need to be loved. And then, as she sat on the porch of the ranch house, contemplating her future, a neighbor boy came by on his pony, carrying a letter, saving the postman a trip. The handwriting on the envelope was unmistakable, the return address a link to the past she'd left behind before the war. Isabel had found her. Wrapped inside Iola's prayer letter was the letter she had received from Isabel in March 1946. Isabel had returned home to the Outer Banks, her husband dead at Normandy. And she herself weakened by a bout of polio. "But there is joy, also. My child has survived. Christina is beautiful, though small, for an infant her age and frail, having suffered such trauma in the womb. But the air here by the sea is good for her. She grows stronger each day. Even Papa dotes on her. She has become the joy of his old age in these recent months. And if he in any way resents the circumstances of her entering this world, he does not show it. Eventually, the past must be buried, and all must be forgiven if life is to go on. While the circumstances of my returning home, the loss of my dear Andrew, sadden me, I count it gain that there has been the opportunity for rebuilding bonds with my father before it is too late. Andrew's death and my long hours in the iron lung have taught me that not one day of our lives is a given, Iola Ann. There comes a moment when time stops. And to each of us, that moment is a mystery. It so often slips around a blind corner. I do not speak of this idly, Iola Ann. It is with a dire purpose that I have gone through the effort of using Papa's considerable contacts with the War Department to find you and send this letter. I must tell you of your mama. The doctors say that she is not much longer for this world. Her fondest wish is that she would see you again. I do not know your financial circumstances, so I have taken the liberty of including train tickets in this envelope. I hope that you and your husband will use them to come to us. Please know also that I love you and have missed you dearly these years since you left. Please come home to us. I realized I was reading the letter out loud to Paul. I hadn't meant to, but I was.
"Wow," he breathed. "What a decision, huh?"
"Yes," I said, and silently returned to the box. I'm afraid to even look at the next one. Paul rubbed his eyes and blinked hard, yawning. It was after 11 already.
Well, surely when she told her husband the truth, he stuck by her.
Hooking a hand over the back of the chair, he rested his chin on it and watched me as I unfolded the next letter and then another, skimmed the words, shook my head. She came home alone, and she came home for good.
So he left her when he found out,
Paul whispered.
He did.
I turned back to the letters as Paul went downstairs to check on the kids. The trail of Iola's words led me on a train ride across the country, and finally a ferry back to Hatteras on a stormy March day, where Isabel was waiting, her legs in braces, her infant daughter nearby in old Rupert's arms. Tears blurred the page as Iola recounted Isabel's words at their reunion.
Oh, Iola Ann, old Rupert told me what he supposes to be the reason for your leaving. Don't you know that sisters are created not by blood, but by love? In my heart, you have not been my niece, but you have always been my sister.
Closing my eyes, I brought the letter to my lips, breathed in the scents of ink and aging paper and truth. Sisters are created not by blood, but by love. All my life, I'd let the ties of blood control me, limit me, define me. Yet I'd ignored the ties of love. I'd shielded myself from the people who tried to slip inside the armor, who told me that I was worthy. Paul came into the room again, giving me an uncertain look as he passed by.
Everything okay?
He asked tentatively. Yes, it's more than okay. A new sense of joy filled me as I returned to the letters, the late night hours slowly giving way to the early hours of morning. J.T. fell asleep on a fainting couch downstairs. Zoe made coffee and continued digging through newspapers, refusing to quit the task and go to bed. Paul and I worked closer to the center of the boxes, narrowing the open window on Iola's life. She'd lived on the island the rest of her years, moving back to Benoit House, first to nurse her mama, then caring for Isabel and little Christina, and for the grandfather who refused to claim her as his own. Isabel, eventually weakened by a bout of influenza that claimed the life of Christina, became bound to a wheelchair, her frame thin and frail, but her spirit undimmed. She discovered a love of photography and became an advocate for the wild banker ponies living on the islands. With Iola's help, she took countless photographs of the horses in their natural habitat, wrote articles for magazines, petitioned the Park Service for care of the horses, and argued against the wholesale roundup and removal of the horses that had survived on the islands for hundreds of years since swimming ashore from shipwrecked Spanish galleons. Even as Isabel's body began to fail, she and Iola fought to preserve the unspoiled beauty of the place that they loved. I drove the car close to the dunes, as far as we dare to go, so as to avoid being trapped in the sand. Isabel recounts the last time we mired our vehicle, and we laughed together about our escapades, our life a grand adventure. We've traveled up to see the banker ponies again today, to take photographs. Remember our rides on the old horse, she asks, and the day we discovered the shipwreck? It was a magnificent day. Yes, it was, I say, and for a moment I see the light of that young girl with dream-filled eyes. I find her inside the body that grows thin and rebels and refuses. I had the life I wanted, she says. I had my adventure. It was shorter than I planned. I wonder if it is ever what we plan. I squeeze her hand, then slip out my door and circle the car to hers. I hope we've done some good, for the horses and the people and the islands. For a moment her gaze is far away. There was no other place I loved so well as this one. Me as well, I say, and I know it is true. For all the places I've loved, there have been none like this. This place is a deeper love, a sisterhood of water and sand and soul. A place where you fill me through my eyes and my ears, Father. I lift Isabel onto my back to carry her over the dunes. She is as light as a child. The camera swings from her hand as I walk. Isabel chatters. This wasting of the body has done nothing to dull her mind. I read that in 5 years there will be a bridge connecting Hatteras from Pea Island to Knight's Head. There will be a paved highway from one end of the banks to the other. No need for the ferry, except perhaps for Ocracoke. Well, I don't know. They say anything in those newspapers. I hear Ethan groan as we pass through the dunes. You sound like the old horse, Isabel teases. I laugh and snort and toss my mane. Be careful, or I'll dump you in the sand. Remember when you let the picnic blanket dangle against the old horse's flanks and he threw us both? I think that was you who let the picnic blanket dangle. I snort again. We, both of us, know who insisted on the blanket with the fancy silk fringe that day so long ago. Isabel was always the one with the grand ideas. They could save themselves the trouble of a bridge, you know, I tell her. In 5 years it will be 1960 and we'll be living in Futurama. I think of that tiny city at the World's Fair, almost 20 years past now. That miniature perfect life with its plastic people. And we'll be coming here by dirigible and auto gyro, remember? When we reach the shore, Isabel tosses a blanket off her shoulder, and it lands on the sand. I spread it with my foot, lower her onto it, and sit beside her. The bank of ponies are nowhere in sight, but they'll be along in their own time. For now, we watch the sea, my sister and I. And the sea is always enough. They say we'll put a man on the moon in not so many years, she tells me. Isabel is taken with Life magazine and National Geographic. I don't believe it, I answer. Men are always trying to solve the mysteries of God, but they never will. She plucks a whelk shell from the sand, contemplates it, turning it over with her bone-thin fingers. There will always be another mystery. God is infinite. She hands the shell to me, and I hold it up, letting the sun shine through it. I think of the creature that once lived here. Perhaps he has outgrown his old home. You tie my mind like knitting thread in very small knots, I complained to Isabel. You always have. I wonder what I will do when she is gone, when the thread runs out and its end drifts beyond my reach. You've always been the wiser one. She lays her tired head on my shoulder and looks through the shell with me, into the great mystery. I think again that heaven must be like this place, and I say that to Isabel. I wonder, when she is in heaven and I'm not, how far away will she be? It's just another journey, she whispers, the long strawberry gold strands of her hair teasing my skin. Heaven? It's one more beautiful adventure. I'm not afraid. Don't worry about me. Christina waits for me there, my little girl. And Andrew. And Maman and Mama T and old Rupert, I remind her. Yes, and all of them. She laughs softly. I think the first thing I'll hear is Mama T singing and Christina's laughter. I think so, too. Her fingers hold mine and we rest him on the sand. You'll take care of Papa? She asks. Somewhere in the distance, I hear the ponies call out. They're coming down to the water. Any time now, the herd leader will appear on the dunes to watch over the smaller and the weaker as they gallop to the shore. I tell Isabel that I will care for Monsieur until he is gone. It won't be many years. He is old and lame, and he has outlived all the ones he loved, except for Isabel. He comes from a different time, my old Anne, she pleads. He doesn't know another way. Forgive him for what he is. I do. I say as the ponies appear on the hill, wild and unbridled. Isabel rouses herself and takes up the camera to preserve yet one more day in this place. One more day together with the sister that love has given me. Forgive me, Father, for asking for another day yet, and another beyond that, when this one is so very beautiful. We, in our humanness, cannot help but foolishly desire eternity in this life. Your loving daughter, Iola Ann. I set the letter aside, swallowed tears, and stood to stretch. Outside, the skies had dried up, a heavy moon casting a silver lining around the clouds above the loblolly pines. Paul had fallen asleep at the desk after finishing the last box before the one I'd opened on the bed. We'd finally come together in the middle. Downstairs, the kids were both sleeping now. In a few hours, the church bells in Fairhope would ring out their morning call to worship. Desperate prayers would be offered up, conversations played out, and legal chatter kicked back and forth in search of some means of saving Iola's house in Fairhope. In a strange way, Iola and the town were finally united. I looked over Paul's shoulder at the letters scattered on the desk. Gerard Benoit, Iola's grandfather and Isabel's father, had died in 1963, just after the Herbert C. Bonner Bridge connected Hatteras to the northern Outer Banks, opening Hatteras to drive-on tourism and changing it forever. The era of quiet, remote life and saltbox houses was over. Gerard Benoit had never acknowledged Iola's blood relation, other than in leaving her the family inheritance that caused her neighbors to accuse her of taking advantage of an old man whose mind was gone. Why she'd kept her secret all her life, I still didn't know. And I guess no one ever would. I laid a hand on Paul's shoulder and woke him. "You don't look very comfortable there," I said. "There's a bed downstairs in the room off the kitchen. Why don't you go catch a little sleep? I think I'll curl up in the parlor with the kids for a while. In the morning, we can go to Binks and print out all the sections we photographed, make the displays for the newspaper articles and whatnot." The poster boards were JT's idea, something resembling the science fair project he was working on in Paul's class, but this display would be about Iola's life. A visual catalog of all that she'd done for the Outer Banks. We planned to include some of Isabel's photographs and her magazine articles. Zoe had unearthed a pile of old Ladies' Home Journal, McCall's, and Life magazines in the storage closet under the stairs, all featuring Isabel's works about the islands. Paul blinked, seeming confused at first about where he was. "You were really asleep," I said, a drowsy chuckle teasing my throat as I peeled back a piece of stationery that was stuck to his arm. There was a sketch on it, a little girl sitting in a metal porch chair, her face buried in her hair.
"I thought we'd put that one on the display boards," he said. "I just like the feel of it. It sort of conveys a moment when all hope seems lost, you know?"
"Feels like it fits the mood," I admitted. Now that we'd gone through the boxes, I wondered if anything we were doing would make a difference. There was money and power on the other end of this struggle. Fairhope was a tiny community of fishermen and working people. There was no political pull here. Paul squeezed my fingers. "We can do this," he promised. And then we walked from the Blue Room together. Chapter 25. Two steps outside the county commissioner's court, I was filled with righteous anger and determination. In my hand, I held a notebook with my speech about Benoit House. Beside me, Paul carried the poster boards on which we'd gathered parts of Iola's story, paragraphs copied from her letters, articles we'd taken from the newspaper stacked among Iola's things, a smattering of Isabel's writings and photography, scraps about the historic value of Benoit House. Like a warrior's armor, they made me feel strong. A shield, a sword, a cause that was worth fighting for. The entire community would hear Iola's story now. They would know her as I had come to know her. Secrets would be revealed and people would finally understand who she was and what she had done. She wasn't a thief, a squatter in Benoit House. She was the daughter of it. She was a small, humble woman who had made her life a gift of service and never asked for anything in return. Not recognition, not fame, not even the gratitude of those she'd helped. A quiet angel. A woman who served a calling first learned from a gentle nun in an orphan's home. If not for the boxes, no one would ever have known. Iola Ann Poole would have disappeared from this place, silent and invisible. Forgotten. If I had anything to say about it, she wouldn't be. Her neighbors here on these narrow strips of sand would see that they owed her the debt of granting her final wish, the only thing she'd ever desired for herself, that her family home, the place she treasured, be preserved. Paul and I had worked all day, Sunday and Monday, on the speech, honing and refining it, while Zoe, JT, and the Banks printed photos of Iola's writings, then clipped and laminated and arranged them with old pictures of the house and Isabel's magazine works. Geneva Bank had done an e-blast of an electronic postcard that Zoe helped design. At the seashell shop, Sandy had shared the information with every business owner on the island and with her list of customers. Mike Mullins, the UPS driver, had taken flyers and given them to his contacts. The hope was that even people who loved a vacation in the Outer Banks might show up at the meeting, flood the commissioner's court with citizens who were more concerned about preserving the island's history and character than satisfying land developers anxious to support rampant construction along the shore. I'd imagined the scene over and over as I practiced the speech, Paul giving me encouraging looks while running a stopwatch. 3 minutes. That's all that was allowed for each person in the public comments forum. 3 minutes. Was it possible to encapsulate an entire life in such a small scrap of time? Geneva Bank would speak before me, talking about the history of Fairhope and its importance to the citizens who lived there. I would follow with my speech about Iola's life and Beignet House, and several other Hatteras residents, including Sandy, would speak after me, with the intent of driving